You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Goings-on in Hong Kong and the global economy and how that all relates to Season 6 of Game of Thrones. I'm joined again by my co-host, Nanshua. Good afternoon.
It's very civil.
Yeah, I know. I'm sad that we're not partaking of local microbreweries, but it is, you know, it's a lunchtime.
It's noon.
It's noon.
Yeah.
You know, it's, well, you know, that is something my mother used to say. It's always 12 o'clock somewhere in the world. Usually with a justification for, well, back in the day it was white Russians for her, which I never was.
This is pre-1980.
Yeah. It was, you know, Pontiac Sunbirds in the driveway and Steely Dan on the 8-track, you know, those types of afternoons. I miss those, if only to avoid summertime heat. Okay, so summertime Hong Kong.
Summertime Hong Kong, we're
hot
boiling.
Boiling.
Hot
and
sick.
And the seas are boiling into a soupy morass of industrial and consumer waste from the Pearl River.
Yes.
Big story recently. You don't live near the ocean these days.
We actually moved. Here's the ironic thing. We actually moved from kind of a more coastal area to about 5-10 minutes from the Shenzhen border, and
wow.
We used to live there, and then we moved away for 2 years, and we moved back, and Shenzhen is looking beautiful, and there are clear skies, and lovely buildings, and it reminds me of like a 1996 Hong Kong,
right.
From the distance,
right.
And yet, our coasts have been just, I was alive.
I know.
Our coasts have been decimated recently.
I'm sniggering at the kind of sci-fi dystopic view of looking at the border of Shenzhen, which once was a communist waste hole. It was like looking over...
It was marsh, wasn't it?
It was looking over the DMZ into North Korea 30 years ago, and now you look wistfully...
From the other side of China.
Right. Now the looking glass is flipped over. To back the listeners up, what we're talking about is the... This summer, well, it happens, I live right on the beach, and this happens every summer when the South China Sea Channel kind of shifts, the tides shift. I mean, you can tell I'm fluent in nautological terms, but there is a shifting
of
the
tides. Not very logical.
No. There's a shifting of the tides in the South China Sea. It's summertime, which kind of takes them through the mouth of the Pearl River, which is, of course, the estuary where China's... Well, it is an estuary. It is the mouth of one of the most, manufacturing-intensive areas of southern China. And for years and years and years, factories and people along the Pearl River dumped
this summer, we're seeing lots of pictures in social media of different, you know, we're seeing swaths of this, that, and the other. And but what I personally found really interesting about this was whenever anything bad happens in Hong Kong, whether it's extra overcrowding or, you know, our property prices just doing another wonderful loop-de-loop, or, you know, the smog, the knee-jerk reaction from people here and netizens is to say, well, it's China's fault.
Right.
And there is some truth to that, because they did find, labels that were definitely not from Hong Kong.
Oh, I see that all the time. I mean, I'm living witness to multiple beach cleanups, and I read the labels, and they are from mainland. They're in simplified characters. I mean, a lot of the medical waste that comes.
See, that's an interesting one. People say medical waste, but there's a lot of debate whether it's. I would be frightened if it was actually genuine of a medical waste of a certain sample size. Okay, because. What the other side of the coin is people saying that that's
actually.
What
are we talking about? Are we talking volume, value? I mean.
Well, I'm talking about a significant breakdown in medical procedures that allows for dumping into the oceans, which is a no-no. So that would worry me. What I've been hearing of are reports of people saying that's split out of context. What they're saying is medical waste is actually stuff from farms, like vets using syringes to. Inject pigs with stuff that we consume. You know,
contamination. Link in the supply chain of death and destruction that rains down on us from the mainland. No, I hear what you're saying, and on both levels. One, that China can't always be a uniform whipping boy for Hong Kong's own. Failings to make its city more livable, but again, I, as a fist-shaking Lantauite, I mean, I live on an island with. Well, we all live on. Well, you don't. You live on the mainland.
I pretty much do. Yeah.
Right, and you live in spitting distance of the mainland. But I mean, from Lantau, as you know, the south part of Lantau is basically occupied by. Indigenous villagers and kind of eco-terrorist hippie wilders who
shake their fists a lot with their seven dogs.
Right. Three. So yes. I am part of that.
Way to bust the stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. I only have three dogs, man. But I have and I have routinely. Gotten together with my fellow villagers it's an impossible task in the summer because it is literally our beach is about 300 meters long, it's about 15 meters deep, and most weekends it is completely covered with a line of here's the thing, a lot of it is just detritus that comes out of the mouth of a very busy
port.
So there's driftwood and there's things that aren't completely noxious.
So do you think
but
that the reason, so as you were saying, this happens every year, but the reason this year it's been particularly bad, so that's always reason to talk about it, but I think what's been interesting about the story to me has been how it's kind of been symptomatic of Hong Kong just having a terrible response. You know, earlier in the year we saw the booksellers and the whole controversy of booksellers basically
give the readers at home or the listeners at home a thumbnail just a
sound bite
a precis.
So Hong Kong has always been lauded for upholding its freedom of speech. It's something that, you know, we who live here really value, and somebody that grew up here, grew up in the expat bubble, but always grew up with the notion that you can say whatever you want. We have freedom of speech here. It's part of our basic law, which is, you know, a main tenet of our basic law, I would say. And it has been seriously challenged this year when three booksellers that were notorious for selling material that criticized the mainland government and its officials suddenly went missing. And what was more worrying about that was, yes, one of them was a Hong Kong national, but one was a Swedish national, and one was a British national.
I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah, those were their passports.
Okay.
And they just disappeared.
They were Hong Kongers.
They were Hong Kongers.
But had
disappeared overnight, and there were, you know, the story kind of dragged on. They appeared on state TV in the mainland, apologizing for their sins, saying that they were liars, and then more recently one of them that returned said, actually, you know, we were taken against our will. So it's been
real
dramatic.
Cultural revolution stuff.
Absolutely. So interesting you should bring up that point, but I think that's what people watching the story unfold is afraid of.
Right.
The parallels between kind of what's happening now and why many of their grandparents came to Hong Kong all those years ago.
Yeah.
So and our government's response to it has just been somewhat pathetic.
True, but again, not to be apologetic about that, but it's a bit of a rock in the hard place because it is part of the basic law that really that Hong Kong is under the National People's Committee's authority, mm-hmm. ultimately, while Hong Kong does encode basic autonomous rights for domestic judicial affairs.
Sure, but these guys, without any process, again, it's a lack of transparency, it's a lack of process, it's a lack of communication between the governments, were taken and questioned.
True. No, I mean, it's
That's fairly unforgivable. I mean, I would have expected our government to have been more outspoken about it. Now, our government, as it turns out, as you know, as perhaps listeners at home might not be aware, is made out of a 1,200-body legislative council that's not quite elected by the people.
Right.
Have got, you know, the majority
of
them. I forgot to register.
No, you came out. Yes, it has elements of democracy, but far more democracy than is available to anyone on the mainland.
Sure.
Not that should be used as a sop to the aspirations of Hong Kong people for greater
universal
political
suffrage.
Yeah.
And, which has always been something that has been on the table.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So draw a line to this and work our way
to Westeros.
To Westeros. Work our way from the South China Sea to Westeros. We have tons of waste from pollution and trash from the mainland heaping itself on our beaches. And yes, despite whether or not it is to inject pigs with steroids or super growth hormones, or whether it's some other form of needlery, I can attest to this, having picked up bales and bales of it, there is tons of medical waste of one type or another amongst all that trash. So we have, this noxious, very visceral and physical embodiment, this daily metaphor for China's creeping role in Hong Kong's life, keeping itself on the beach day and day. We have
we're being shot on.
slow but steady and tangible erosion of these freedoms that we've held dear under the basic law, and an unresponsive and unwilling to be combative in the interests of its people.
To the whole trash picking, we had our chief executive donning gloves and posing for press photos,
menacingly holding a pair of tongs and
holding
up
a pair of tongs. And it came out late, and I don't know if this is verified, so forgive me if I'm just.
They prepared the trash for him to pick up.
Right? I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, it was actually at the beach once. If I had known, it was he was picking trash at the beach.
And said hi.
Yeah, I could have gone and heaped medical waste upon him.
Check those eyebrows out in real life.
So. Bottom line, and before again we hop on the boat to Westeros, the response from the government, this is disappointing, but do you think that this is unidirectional? In other words, are we just in for more of the same over the next 30 odd years of the basic law? Is Hong Kong going to kind of slowly crumble from on glistening cosmopolitan entrepot to dirty backwater sort of shoved into China's back pocket?
Let's hope not, but there are structural weaknesses that outside of what's happening with China, which is, it's the whole China piece is obviously impacting confidence of people coming into Hong Kong, of, you know, what does it mean for me, not now, but 5, 10 years, can I actually establish a business here? Obviously, there are impacts, and there are going to be echoes from it, but, you know, there are also elements where Hong Kong has very much lost its edge. The pollution problem's gotten so bad that people are leaving in droves.
Yeah.
You know, and again, this is very much looking at it from the perspective of the expat community. But yes, people are leaving it. And
many of those hundreds of thousands of folks who gathered Australian or Canadian passports before 1997 are dusting them off again
to Australia. The locals are thinking of moving for you know, political reasons as well as the health and the lifestyle and the fact that it's becoming a harder and harder place to live.
Hmm.
You know, that widening gap between the wealthy and the middle class before we even get to the poor. We've got some of the world's largest collection of BMWs per capita, but also one of the world's largest inequality gaps. And this is 7 million people.
You made me feel bad for owning a BMW. We bought it third hand, man.
You should take a long look at yourself.
Long, hard look at myself.
So there's that piece. But there's also, you know, the pollution, the fact that Hong Kong's gotten a lot less competitive. It used to be the place that people came to get into China. Now people are going into China directly. Our government lauded this One Belt, One Road initiative early in the year, but Hong Kong's been pretty much cut out of it. It's
like a grommet on the belt.
Our port used to be the number one port in the world, and that's been overtaken by China. So we've lost a lot of our edge. And meanwhile, you look at other places. You look at Singapore. A lot of the tech hubs have moved there. So Google and Facebook have had their headquarters there for many years. LinkedIn.
Mm.
The offices in Hong Kong are sales offices.
Right. Well, I will push back on that a little bit in that there's a logic there in that those three companies that you've mentioned are virtually non-present in China and cannot be present in China in the way they'd like to for reasons of regulatory opacity and the great firewall of China.
They can still operate from here as many media companies do and have and used to do. Actually, I used to work for a media company that has, over the years, I've seen many of their operations move to Singapore, and the government encourages it. There are lots of grants and lots of kind of tax benefits for setting up there.
You put one can on the shelf and then you went and opened up another can and
let's see the can.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a particularly brimful of worms can for me. That sort of Singapore versus Hong Kong rivalry issue. And you're absolutely right. Singapore does more to coax business away, and in a way. Rivalry between city states is a little bit better of a metaphorical bridge back to Game of Thrones. And where I was going before you went there was I was thinking about the ecological disaster that's been forming on our borders, and I was kind of do a wall and ice zombie environmental degradation metaphor in Game of Thrones.
Yep.
But let me then, rather than try to knit it together inarticulately, let me just sort of throw all these things out. We have geopolitical turmoil. We have here in Hong Kong and globally a sense of dread around global shifting geopolitical plate tectonics. We have massive environmental issues. Mm. We have concerns about quality of life and income inequality. How much do you feel when you watch Game of Thrones or when you've read the books, do you feel that it is it trying to have its escapism cake and eat its political messaging too? In other words, do you feel that
there's going to be something at the end of it that kind of ties a big moralistic statement?
Well, no, I'm asking more sort of what you kind of read along the way. This season in particular, could you Do you see commentary about the state of the world when you the real world when you watch the troubles of Westeros unfold?
I think we've touched on the idea of self-interest before, the idea of the houses, you know, and the goal, because it was a simpler time, was for the houses to gain their power and restore their former glory.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say echoes of that, but it's very parallel universe, isn't it? When you look at what happened with Brexit recently, for example, where you could maybe draw parallels.
The masses rose up and voted against their self-interest.
It's more so that role of influence that people of power have.
Right.
And what have the yous. I don't think you can. I'm sure you can draw parallels. I'm sure.
But do you? I guess I'm asking. Do you get a real sense of political allegory, or do you have to really squint?
I don't have to squint. I think I find Game of Thrones has one part escapism, but also has got some really interesting kind of paradoxes. One of my favorite things, if we're talking about political commentary, right, is when you start with a character like Jaime Lannister. Everyone hated that guy, and now you know we're all kind of rooting for him. So
all of us, you are.
I have no real strong feelings. I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Replace beer with tuna.
Looking at two sides of a story. If anything that global politics have taught me recently is what a massive sampling bubble I live in. I never thought Brexit could happen. I never thought Trump could get to where he is. But
Boris Johnson in this allegory?
I hope nobody's Boris Johnson in this allegory or Trump. The interesting piece for me has been the two sides to every story element.
Okay.
And Game of Thrones has been very good at showing us both sides of the coin, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess from a political commentary perspective, in the real world, we're seeing this massive rise of extremism or rightist politics, where the everyday man feels like, hey, I'm poor and I'm getting poorer, and that guy's saying something I like. He's right. For coal. And there's also no, you know, kind of accountability. With Brexit, we saw the Leave camp spouting lies, and then they all left. And nobody's accountable. And we're kind of seeing a lot of that globally and across the political sphere.
So maybe the real escapism is that we actually see consequences for actions in Game of Thrones. We actually kind of want to see our politicians or our political actors
off held, his head.
held accountable and hung or strung up or
it just seems a lot simpler, doesn't it?
Raped by science zombies. Well, in that last scene where Cersei got her revenge, or actually it was the first set piece of the finale. I want to circle back to your Jamie
the character of Jamie, how we've kind of got a 360 view of him.
Right.
Now,
so we've come or 180.
180, okay.
Because you haven't come back to thinking of him as an asshole again yet.
No.
But Cersei also has been somewhat rehabilitated in fans' eyes by just being a complete badass and blowing up everybody that messed with her and kind of savoring her revenge. But even that, she didn't uniformly come away from that unscathed. Yes, everybody that did her harm was either blown up or, as I say, you know,
sexually
tortured by a science zombie. But I have to say science zombie now to distinguish it from the actual Meister zombie.
I mean, this is like geekery heaven here. I mean, there are so many parallels. So let me take all that. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Are we?
And let's
oh, you wanted
take
to do.
Back.
Sorry, you wanted to do a recap.
Not a recap. But I wanted to look at episode one and then use that almost as a framework to talk about the rest of it, and then we can connect it back to politics.
Right on.
You know, I'd love to.
Sorry. Foreshadowing, backshadowing, reshadowing. Take it away.
Okay, so episode one of season six. We are back at Jon Snow, the corpse. It's different from Jon Snow, who's alive. And
he's another type of zombie. What kind of zombie is he?
There are so many kinds of zombies. They're
like
a new Pokemon. So Jon Snow's corpse is found by Ser Davos. And the other loyalists, they take him inside, they lock themselves behind a door with him, then Thorne assumes command of the Watch. So it's all happening in the north. Then let's look at, what else is happening? Ramsay is distracted, and then Sansa and Theon escape through the woods. I mean, it was the worst escape ever. They walked 20 meters and then were found.
Yeah.
And then Brienne catches up with them. And then Jaime comes home with Missella's body and promises Cersei they will take their revenge. You know, that was quite an interesting point.
Yeah.
And that was very much foreshadowing, I'd say. But also, in many ways, a conclusion of one of the storylines, because Jaime as a character had decided, okay, well, he's a soldier. He needs an objective, right? That's been kind of part of his narrative. He needs to be doing something.
Right.
And he found that something. What else was happening? Obara and Nymeria murder their brother on his way home from King's Landing.
Right.
And then Jorah and Daria continue to track Daenerys, who is now with the Dothraki, as we find out.
Right.
And then Arya is begging, is blind, and gets beaten up by a waif.
Right.
Oh, and then of course, I mean, and this is speaking of zombies.
Yeah.
Melisandre removes her necklace. And is old. She looks like one of the witches from Roald Dahl. And that just... We just forget that. That just... You know, that happens. Everyone freaks out. Lots of jokes on Twitter. And then that's just kind of swept to the side.
Right.
Because I think we all knew she was some kind of crone...
Elder being.
from the bowels of time with a purpose.
Okay. So within that, let's sort of take... Let's take each of those major characters and kind of... quickly follow them through the season and let me hear what you make of their trajectory. So, okay. Jon Snow kind of comes back to life, gets mopey, gets a man bun.
Broods a lot.
Broods even more.
I mean, his repertoire of broodery is quite staggering.
Man buns himself up, gets a pimpin' pelt,
right?
And then goes through to become, well, I mean, not we don't have to well, you know, how many interim steps you want to take between that?
Talk through from where he started to where he ended up. So reunites with Sansa. That was a really nice episode.
Yeah,
you know, I think viewers were waiting for that to happen. I was. You know, I was strangely
alive.
Yeah, I mean, that was so going to happen. I mean, there were enough signs. I mean, I hoped it would happen because
right.
I think, if I'm being truly honest, I just one of the parts that I can't wait that hasn't happened yet that I hope will happen is when he finally meets Daenerys. I don't actually care what happens after that. I just now that it's confirmed that he is part Targaryen, part Stark, and so the whole white wolf thing makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He had a dire wolf. The whole coming back from the whole witchcraft, sorcery,
right.
Darkness into light, fire god. Everyone seems to have a different thought on who he is or what
right.
he should be.
Well,
he's
at once kind of a protector and savior of the old ways, and yet he was brought back to life by the new way. He's sort of this hybrid character in more ways than one. He's sort of this great healer. He's like Barack Obama. I mean, if we're looking for political metaphor, you know, he's the bridger and the knitter of worlds. But do you feel? I mean, his pouty ermined, man-bunned gaze aside.
He has got a lot to pout about, okay? He is one of the only characters that truly knows what's coming.
Right.
And it's scary, and they're tall, and they're icy.
Do you feel, I mean, are you just emotionally, do you connect with John?
Emotionally, I connect to the stage where he is, where he's reluctantly assumed power, like many of the leading men across all of fantasy as a genre.
Right.
He's reluctantly been placed in a position of power, and it's going to be fun as a viewer and as a reader to watch him hopefully, you know, get to a place where he deserves that power that's been placed.
This is, I tried to bring this up in the last episode, but I didn't do so very articulately, which is kind of says a lot about me, in my ability to
self-deprecate.
that plus unarticulate things that are buzzing around in my head. But we did talk about the emerging feminist narratives in Game of Thrones, and at the end of this season, you see very clearly, if you kind of look at the big board of risk that's stacking up, you've got between the sand snakes, Danny and I forget what they call the ironborn queen in this one.
Yara.
So we have the Dari. The Danny Yara show, we've got the Sand Snake show, and we've got Cersei, so we've got like these three kind of power bases that are run by, and to a certain extent defined by, the motivations of their female characters. But they're not just inheriting power or sort of, you know, Benazir Bhutto-ing it by picking up the mantle from a, you know, beloved father figure. They are all kind of coming into their own as political agents, and then you have Sansa in the North, kind of like sort of just kind of sidestepping that mantle herself.
Just on Sansa, I really enjoyed watching her character develop. You know, after seasons of just being meek and this was a girl that really believed that if you did everything you were supposed to do, everything was going to come right.
Right.
And then found out very quickly that if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, you know, I mean, when you look at her and John, for example, John, of all these characters that you just mentioned, all these really strong feminist characters, does not have the same level of self-interest. He effectively doesn't know who he is. He's a Snow. So he's not doing this to restore glory. He's doing this because he's been put in a position where he can, or he has to in order to survive, or a sense is looking at it. And, you know, Littlefinger obviously talking in her ear, and that's going to nag at her, has suffered through a lot at the hands of others and has shown a keenness for strategy and a keenness for diplomacy as well. If it wasn't for her, you know, sticking to her guns and meddling, as it were, they would have lost that battle. You know, the Tullys would have never shown up.
Right.
So I think that's probably happening, and she's realizing she's got a claim, and right now she's happy to support her brother and have him, you know, be glorified as the King of the North. But that final shot where Baelish looks at her, and she sort of has this nodding, kind of knowing look. That was interesting to me.
Well, what did you think that look knew? Because I'm of two minds, but you, tell me, what was she thinking when she looked back at Littlefinger when
she
everybody said,
exactly
all hail
is.
The Snow?
Yeah, which I like. She kind of, she knows exactly what he is. And she knows, he's, for the first time, he's been completely transparent and confirmed her beliefs in, you know, probably what she suspected on what he ultimately wanted, which was the Iron Throne.
Okay,
so
but then...
But the second piece, it has been there for her. He has come to her aid. And she's probably wondering, does he have... I feel like what he said earlier about her having the most claim for that position, Queen of the North, what have you. It's going to nag at her, I think, because she's proven to herself and to everyone else that perhaps she could be.
Right, okay. I have a slightly different take. I'd be interested to hear it on your take. In fact, let's do a podcast about this. So, I hear what you're saying, but to my mind, what I saw in that was, I saw in that look, like, I saw, okay, now it's, now your move, like, to, while it was, while, in other words, while Sansa sort of stepped out, or, well, she didn't really, she didn't decline any power, nothing was... Nothing was
sure.
done.
But are you saying she looked at him and said, "Well, this is what I've chosen. So your move.
I'm aware that you think that if I were the Queen of the North, it would make your path to the Iron Throne easier. And so, therefore, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to be okay with Jon taking up the mantle." Because that leaves you, that puts an extra obstacle in your way, and I want to do it. So in other words, I think she is, she's not revenge, but I think she's insulating herself from him, and in a sense, kind of squaring off again. So she's set him back a bit, and I think while she didn't engineer it that way, I think she purposely sort of leaned into the political fervor which gripped everyone because some 10-year-old told these old beardos off.
Oh, my God, what a star,
yeah,
Lady Mormont.
Yeah, she's got a good career ahead of her.
Yeah, so just to end on that, I completely see that as well, and I think it can go either way, but I think one thing that we both agree on is Sansa is... Sick or Shansha or however they pronounce it really oddly on the show. Listen to how Jon Snow says Sansa. It's not.
I just thought it was because he was an emo mumble boy and couldn't enunciate well.
With his man bun.
the man bun is lifting his.
I think
face
the one
muscles
thing
back.
We can agree on is she is sick of being used and is going to do her best to not be in a situation where she can be somebody's pawn again.
Right.
And she also has an independent streak.
Right.
Within her, which I think is great, which has made her character a lot more interesting than the girl that liked lemon cakes in season one.
Right, right.
So I'm excited to see what happens with her. And the fact that she's got a bit of that stark badassery that we reserved up until now for just Arya, who spent a lot of the season just getting beaten up.
Daredevil
and then
style.
And then fought back. And then it just went on to this insane next level of I'm stabbed, but I'm okay because I planned it. And here's her face. And now I'm going to go killing people. That's essentially what happened in 10 episodes.
Do you subscribe to the theory that the Waif was really just her alter ego and that she was like, Arya was just schizophrenically crazy and battling herself and she had to put her other self? No? Okay.
No, because I think they had to close that chapter on... The man, what's that hall called? The hall with many faces. The place that the masks of the dead people.
Yeah.
And I think
hall with many faces works for me.
I think it was a test, but not a formal test. That she proved herself and went, look, I killed this bitch.
Yeah.
Like, leave me alone. I'm gonna go do my thing now. I have a name. Don't care what you think. I'm psycho. Let me just be psycho.
Yeah.
So.
A well-trained murderous psycho.
She went Sweeney Todd at the end. Okay,
as
satisfactory as that was to see, I did have a moment.
So, do you think she's going to hook up again with what's his name, the Hound?
I hope so, because they're frenemies at this stage, you know.
Right.
I was going to trade you in, I nearly killed you, but they have this kind of, you know... She very much, in the book and in the first series, benefited from the tutelage of her older brothers. And it was nice to see kind of that tender side of her come out again because everything was taken away from her.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the book kind of... The last we see of the book, and again, you know, I've shared with you my theories that I don't think that any more of these books are going to get written.
See,
but,
I'm just tossing and looking away because
I know. Well, okay, fine.
The thought.
Well, see, again, I'm still, I'm interested in.
I'm going to tweet this man right now.
In a world.
Where's my phone? George R.R. Martin.
Well, yeah, like you want to be the 300,000th person today to nag him about when
the book coming out.
Yeah.
I really, really like it. Yeah. I like your words.
So, I think if I were J.R.R.M., I'd probably be thinking to myself, well, I could, you know, lounge around in my pit of money for a little while, or I could write. Leave the money out of it. I think he's probably thinking to himself that the cultural impact he's having is now book dominant, and he's got to wonder what that. He's not going to get that back.
It's not book dominant.
It's no longer book dominant. It's now show dominant, and if that's going to
I think that's a really interesting kind of layer of or part of the experience of our time. And I think the last person to really go through this at that scale was J.K. Rowling, right? Who at the stage can't seem to let go of Harry Potter. Not that I would ever want her to, but it's a really interesting post-book, post-movie time that we're in, where there are more details coming out of the canon, but from the source. But the difference with her and you know, George R.R. Martin is the extra details are coming from the showrunners and the writers of the show. And from whatever I've read, that there's a really great relationship there. I also think, and this is purely my observation on how conscientiously these characters were developed, the way it was written, that he's not going to leave it hanging. I think he owes it to those characters. Forget the fandom. It's such a great series.
But, I mean, when they come out, and already there are critical... This season has created critical divergent paths between what's been set up. And even if he does try to mimic or reroute the narrative to more or less parallel track the show.
Mm.
The books are going to be sort of seen as I would say almost
redundant. You've got a really interesting point, but I don't
agree with that.
I don't agree with the idea that he has any reason to feel jealous or that his success has been apportioned onto HBO now. And I don't think it's something that he would agree with. I think...
Well, I'm not saying he's jealous. I'm just saying, like, you know, I think he wants...
The way you're talking about it is fairly... like, he would spitefully withhold the narrative.
No. I think he just was spitefully. I just think he thinks that... I mean, he's always been someone who sort of, you know, he's a lover of genre. I mean, he was a passionate
comic book guy.
Passionate science, pulp science fiction guy. I think he loves the medium, and he strives for greatness and contributing to that. And I think he wants the greatest possible impact. And I don't think that I still think he thinks that he is. Despite the fact that there are showrunners that do more of the actual writing, I suspect he sees himself as the spiritual leader of the show as well. So
the chief shaman, chief executive,
the meister of the show,
the meister. If we took it, you know, straight to the very, very basics, I think he's got a great book. Or a great series of books and really great characters, and I think his own personal compulsion is to finish them.
Okay.
Let's do something. I never do a compromise. Let's assume he never publishes the rest of them, which I don't think will happen because this man's never going to get any peace until he does.
Well.
He's still going to finish it. I think as a writer, how can you not?
Fair enough. Okay.
And that is the last Dear listeners, they're probably bored to tears of us riffing on this particular point. Okay, so we've spoken about John, we've spoken about Arya and Sansa, so we're going through the Stark kids.
Right, so let's move through time and space for a little bit and kind of do a mini forecast prediction on what
rapid fire prediction.
Yeah, well, more sort of now that we've sort of seen where the Stark pieces are on the map. You know how every 3 episodes somebody goes into a massive map room and just happens to have beautiful hand carved wolf heads or flayed men on the boards. We have.
Or Sansa carrying that seal with her,
right,
through her times of duress.
So we've got the North sort of reclaimed by Starks. We've got another Stark and River Run, and
dragons.
I'm not even talking about the southern bit. I'm just, where do you see the motion going next season? Do you see Arya going north, the Hound going north,
okay,
Jon and Sansa coming down, or just staying put?
The Stark narrative is
for the zombies.
Digging for the zombies. I think of all of them, Jon Snow has this big, massive war that he's got at the back of his head. It's like this big fuck-off war that's coming. We're all going to die. And his objective is going to be to unite the North and get them ready.
Okay.
I think.
But he's already kind of done that.
There's a lot more to do.
Who else needs uniting? I mean, everybody. What others? He's got the Wildlings. He's got everybody. Like I said, you know, all those old farts got shamed by Lady
They're
Mormont.
They're
going
to have to move south and get the other houses, not just the House of the North.
Okay, so you're not talking about uniting the North. You're talking about uniting the Seven Kingdoms.
Uniting the Seven Kingdoms and making, or at least making them aware of what's going to happen. I'm not convinced he's united the North. I know they've all pledged and we all felt, you know, really good at that point.
Heart swelling.
And oh, there was Lady Mormont being badass again, and that was great. But, you know, in practice, it's very different. So I think it's not going to be the end of young Jon Snow's troubles when it comes to the Wildlings and the Northern Bend.
So it's
going
to be more political machinations and trying to get more resources or convince others to commit resources to the defense of the ice zombies, which now we have an interesting sort of subtext.
They can't come
because didn't Uncle Benji, half zombie Benji say,
I can't move.
Yeah.
But interesting narrative point from Bran's point of view.
Mm.
When he touched, and this is from my husband, I can't claim, you know, I mean, we're that couple that sit with our dinner and talk about Game of Thrones.
Are you watching Game of Thrones while you're eating dinner?
Well, no, we're not. This is like weeks afterwards.
Okay.
Hey, random thought.
Okay.
You know that time when Bran screwed it all up by touching a three-eyed raven because he was so curious?
Right.
After he did that and one of the Ice Walkers touched him,
mm-hmm,
he was able to go into the Children of the Corn, the forest. Sacred place.
Right.
Now that has Bran been contaminated, is he going to lead to the fall of the wall?
Okay. All right. That's. I'd say Bran is kind of like the Mr. Magoo of Westeros.
Yeah,
and everything
Bran
he touches sort of
Benji
Stark
is like, right, good luck, y'all. I'm going to go do what I can.
Well. No. Do you think he was trying to get away from the train wreck that is Brandon?
No, I think Brandon Stark has got a very is off roading. He's got a very
to
interesting
the extent that he can with a 90-pound woman lugging him around.
Yes.
I think
you know, there's a lot of additional witchcraft with Brandon. The whole hold the door, traveling through time and dimension, and
so he's going to mess things up before he makes them better.
Yes.
Okay. So he's going to poke a hole through the wall. The ice by the end of next season, ice
zombies.
kind of will come through. Jon Snow will be kind of trying to politic his way into some sort of loose confederation. And will he be able to do so with the help of Jaime?
I don't know. I think Jon meeting Jaime. I think Jon meeting Tyrion also would be an interesting one.
Okay, that seems a little hard.
But I'm gonna stick to it.
Okay, fine. No, I think they probably will meet again. However, I think it's going to be hard for Dany to get her head around that when all she hasn't even kind of come to terms with that. She's in many ways, I actually think that Dany's kind of invasion of Westeros is most problematic. I mean, she's going to unleash an army of she's going to unleash a Mongolian horde on Westeros, and they're not going to be content with just fighting for her. They're going to, what's she going to do? Just pack them off afterwards?
I'm sensing a theme of reluctant armies wherever they are.
Well, I think they're all going to be super keen, but afterwards they're going
to. I think geographically it's important they're all in the same place because they're all going to have to fight against the zombies. Right, I think, and I am assuming that's where it's going. The fact that all these central characters are coming into one playing space.
Okay, so Dany lands, Cersei squares off the sand. The Dorne people come in and kind of they come in from the other flank because clearly, because Varys has the power of teleportation. And can just
what sort of time scales are we talking about?
I'm never one of these guys that
picks the holes out, but that bothered me as well.
Well, it did, but no. What I was going to say is, actually, I think when I first read The Lord of the Rings when I was in sort of middle school, I was furiously going back and forth to the map, and I actually had a really nice copy of the Lord of the Rings that had one of those maps that was fold out, and something that looked exactly like that thing that later cropped up as the navigation page in the DVD version of the Peter Jackson films. So I did kind of plot their journey on the map, and I've not really been one to do that in Westeros terms, but soon as I saw Varys kind of go poof, leave Dorne in a cloud of smoke and wind up on at the front of Dany's kind of war armada, I did look at the map and it is
kind of on the way, right?
Yeah, it's conceivable that he didn't go all the way back, but that shot was kind of, as they've rounded the corner, they could have picked him up on there's a little bit of isthmus that you kind of have to pass through the narrow sea to go around to King's Landing, and he could have been out on a cliff with his thumb out and gotten picked up, and that's the only way it could have happened.
Okay, one more thing. I don't think they're going to King's Landing because
where are they going?
Because
they're all steamed up. Who's gonna fight?
Well, they're not gonna start fighting. They're gonna probably go to Dragonstone. Who else is there?
Now I gotta look at that damn map.
Who else is there?
Where's the Dragonstone? That's like north. It's like way north.
Not way north.
Okay. All right.
But because when you whenever anyone's
talking about maps on a podcast,
whenever you try, as we go on our cartographic adventures. By the art of diction, every time anyone's tried to take King's Landing by sea, it's kind of not worked.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Okay.
And I think, where else would Dany go but Dragonstone, where, I mean, Thingy's not there anymore. What was his name? The one that burnt his daughter.
Stannis. Thingy.
He's not
daughter,
there anymore.
Daughter burning Thingy. The worst curse you could ever
The Onion Knight and his army and out with Jon Snow. I mean,
right.
You know...
What army? There's no Stannis army left.
Okay, like the three guys.
You can count them on the fingers of one hand.
obviously there's... I think before the next series, let's do a recap. And sadly, the next series is not going to start in April. It's going to... April, rather.
It's going to start
in June, and it's going to be seven episodes long. So each of those the best.
Well, yeah, there's supposed to be two more seasons, and they're both supposed to be fairly short. Well, yeah, they'll have to be
at this point.
A lot
of it was getting to places.
Right. So then, kind of, and I'm sorry to, as usual, I've rabbit-holed you a little too much on things that might not have been central to your to your core narrative, but to kind of get
well,
you
that's
to
how the book works in the series, doesn't it? It's just
so prediction. Well, sort of assessment of back to Jaime and Cersei. You started off sort of saying how he's kind of returned to, or not returned. He's sort of become a sympathetic character and one who has changed and grown, and kind of comes back home to find that his sister may have changed, but she hasn't really grown. In fact, she's now finally kind of fulfilled the prophecy, mm-hmm. or most of the prophecy, and
the Valonqar.
So do you think that's going to cause, everyone's talking about how that's going to cause Jaime to kind of go off the reservation and kind of finally break with Cersei, but I'm convinced.
I think if there's anything that could cause him to do that, it's this. Because one of the main reasons people ended up sympathizing with Jaime is when he saw what decisions he took in order to become the Kingslayer, right?
Mm.
Aerys the Mad King was going to burn everyone with wildfire.
Yes.
And that was his justification.
Right.
You know, you kill the one for the interests of many.
Right.
His sister went out and did that. And, you know, if we follow his own logical...
Oh, you the fuck up!
Yeah. Like, bye, Felicia. So, I don't think it's going to be this one thing. I think it probably will startle him. It will plant the seed of doubt, and I think her actions after this point will prove her to be the Mad Queen. I mean, she had some crazy Michael Jackson-esque wardrobe change in the last couple of episodes
there. Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of the shows and the textiles and the details in what happens, it's things like summer and winter and what people wear and how they relate to each other and the traditions.
But didn't Jaime say, I mean, Jaime sort of throughout this season, the one consistent message he had, whether for Cersei herself or Edmure during that sort of scene where he convinced him to help take back River Run by telling him that he had no other interests other than his sister. I mean, he's been consistently saying, I don't care about any of this, it's just me and my sister. Do you think he might just go back and say, well, okay, she's consolidated some power, and so, yeah, given that all I care about is the two of us.
Maybe the beginning, but I don't think who he thinks she is the person she is anymore. She's suffered, you know, in every attempt to protect herself from the prophecy, she's just drawn herself closer to it in great narrative, you know, fashion.
Right.
And I think Jaime's going to have a choice at some point. And it's going to be a crossroads, and he's going to have to choose. And it's going to be interesting as a viewer to see it. I hope for the development of the character that he doesn't go back to Cersei, and he doesn't, and that or he does, but he doesn't, he isn't duped for long.
Well, he's going to pretty soon have to defend her kingdom against Dany et al. And he's probably going to have to, if you're right, if Dany's heading to Dragonstone and then coming down, he's going to have to fight that war on two fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Which will he engage with first, do you reckon?
I think Tyrion's actually going to be an interesting factor in all of this.
Okay.
Because he had said, if he ever sees Tyrion again, that's it, he's done.
Right.
But I don't know, I think I actually don't know what I think. That's probably the best part of this thing. It keeps you guessing. And we'll just have to see. I can only tell you what I hope, which is
right. Let's go with that.
That he doesn't that his story doesn't end there.
Right.
That he doesn't support his sister to the point of his own detriment. I would love to see a reconciliation between him and Tyrion. I really like what's happening with Dany and Tyrion at the moment. It's you know, made for a lot of light moments and just that lovely welcome bits of witticism and frolic during all the bits of, you know, down south. One thing I didn't like was how sloppy. It was quite sloppy how she came back though.
Mm.
Like, oh look, there are
like
bones. Oh look, it's me, and there's my dragon.
Yeah.
I couldn't control him before. We've forgotten all that. It's fine.
Yeah.
Last question. This one's to you.
Hey.
There has always been, I think, from the beginning, this idea of three dragons and three riders. We know who one of them is.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a popular theory that people think that the second one is going to be Jon Snow, and now that he's got Targaryen blood, it's looking a lot more likely. Other people say Tyrion. I'm not convinced Tyrion's ever going to ride a dragon, although how that would look amazing. That would be like a badass image to appreciate forevermore. Who do you think the third rider is going to be? Or the second and third? Or are we ever going to see three dragons and three riders?
I think we will only in that sort of this season. This season has sort of shown that one of the things that the showrunners are good at is incorporating fan gestalt into outcomes. I think they will. I mean, they don't necessarily pander to fan requirements, but they do. They do now know
what people like.
They are kind of, you know, reading the tea leaves of. You know, Reddit chatter and whatnot, and have figured that these big questions, that there are a set number of big questions that need answering. So, long way to go about saying that. I think, given the modern way popular entertainment is constructed, that is to say, by the creators siphoning off streams of social media and kind of plugging it into their thought process, that there will be three riders. And I do think that, again, as you've said, the only other Targaryen, secret Targaryen there is Jon, so he will be rider number two. I guess Tyrion would be an interesting one for a third, although
it's that symbolism, isn't it?
I mean, that's sort of it's also kind of brings in another house into the equation.
What is the third dragon? Because there's a Drogon who is Khal Drogo, you know, this manifestation who Dany rides. There's Rhaegal,
which is named after her brother. So
yeah, who I assume Jon Snow.
Done,
you know, that's
okay.
His dad.
Right. So
I can't remember who the third one is.
No, I can't.
Is.
So listeners, write in the comments below. I mean, I guess sort of for the whole sort of symbolic synergy that makes sense. I actually sort of feel that things will probably end a little messier than we'd like them. I could see maybe one of the dragons getting kind of nailed.
I hope it does to an extent, because I think I totally agree with what you're saying. I think they have pandered to us in many ways.
Maybe they'll stop.
And
they'll probably take us. So the next season will probably sort of shake us up a little bit, and then things will kind of careen to a successful end. So, on that note of successful ends, take me back to the original semi-premise. Is this going to start? Is Game of Thrones going to continue to mimic geopolitical tremors in the world as it carries on, or do you think it will just, I don't say just, but I mean, it's obviously been an incredibly cathartic and important bit of escapism for us, precisely because it has these little polished mirrors that it holds up to our global landscape. Do you think that's going to become serendipitous as time goes on, more intentional?
I hope that it serves to remind us of what happens when you get so caught up in your own self-interest that you forget the greater issues of the environment, of greater threats to all of mankind, as opposed to what the immediate short-term perceived gains are.
Right.
Yeah, that just kind of came out of nowhere.
Wow.
What's in this water?
yeah.
Medical waste, clearly.
Yeah, exactly. So you're looking to Game of Thrones for healing.
I think every great canon has had elements of like this final.
Yeah, even if we've kind of read too much into them, like, you know, famously,
yeah.
Lord of the Rings was not supposed to be about World War One or Two, and
there were no elves in World War One and Two.
Oh, I know. There are no dragons today.
And I met a few people.
Right. Well,
Viseron was the third dragon.
Viseron, okay.
That would have after the brother.
Viseron. So where can we go with that?
Varys.
Oh, dude.
No, it's not going to be Varys. That would be just really random and sloppy.
And he doesn't need it because he can teleport.
He can teleport.
He doesn't need to ride dragons. Dragons are too slow.
I'd be interested to know what other people think
as
well.
Okay.
So who would be riding the third dragon?
Okay. The winner of the discussion will
get a syringe from the South.
We'll get a commemorative bit of medical waste from the South China Sea. So right in, folks. Nashua, thank you very much for joining me this fine and frying Friday afternoon.
Thank you very much. This was great. And I will see you in roughly a year from now.
Yeah, hopefully. Maybe we'll find some other form of geekery to blend with our views of the Pearl River Delta and its flotsam and jetsam. On that note, I'm Ross for Nashua, saying have a great weekend.